Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
My guest today is Maurice Rasabi, who has written a book on Kublai Khan and a general history of the Mongols, published by Oxford University Press. And this week, we are just going to discuss the Mongol history and we're going to discuss Genghis Khan. I'm sorry, I cannot resist doing that Star Trek reference. But anyway, let's begin with talking about how did you get into Mongol history in the first place?
How did I get into it? I got into it through Chinese history. I did some work in traditional Chinese foreign relations and got into, of course, the neighboring areas and realized that there had never been a biography of Kublai Khan. And since I knew Chinese and since I knew some of the Middle Eastern languages, those are the two primary sources on Kublai Khan, and that provided me the basis for writing a book on the subject. It turned out, because of Marco Polo, who mentions Kublai Khan, and one of the main characters in Marco Polo's book is Kublai, and the Samuel Taylor Coleridge poem about Xanadu, which mentions Kublai Khan, that it became quite popular and sold quite a few copies. And then I got really interested more and more in Mongolian history per se. And that moved me forward, not just to the Chinese aspect of the Mongols, but Mongolian history. And I began to be fascinated by the environment of Mongolia, which is truly remarkable and difficult, an arduous lifestyle. It's made up it's one of the northernmost cultures in the world, and so you have devastating winters in Mongolia, which explains a lot of Mongolian history. As we'll try to figure out why Genghis Khan arose and why Genghis Khan moved forward, a lot of it had to do with environmental issues that plagued the Mongols. The winters are devastating, and so in order to survive sometimes, and in order for the animals to survive, they have to move in a different direction. In terms of the environment, the central part of Mongolia is the so-called steppe land. That's where the grasses are. You cannot have agriculture there. It's too cold. The growing season for plants is too limited. And so the basic kind of economy is based on animals, and five animals in particular, the most important being sheep. Goats are important as well, but in terms of the economy, the sheep are the most significant. Then, of course, as they have an animal-centered economy, they move more and more towards domesticating the horse, domesticating camels, and domesticating horses in particular was vital for Mongolian history because it gave them what turned out to be their most important weapon, and that was the cavalry. Without the cavalry and without their ability to domesticate horses, they would not have been as important a military force in the world. But you may want to intrude here, and I don't want to dominate our conversation.
No, that's fine. Don't worry. I like it. So let's talk about one of the most essential sources, and that is, of course, this secret history, or as I like to call it, the not-so-secret history anymore. But, you know, but it was secret at the time, and it was kept hidden for a long time. And so let's talk about the essential of secret history, or how important it is for understanding Genghis Khan.
Sure. Well, the Mongols did not have a written language till Genghis Khan came on the scene. Genghis commissioned the development of a written Mongolian by one of his scribes, and that led to the first effort to bring together Mongol legends, Mongol history, and that effort led to the creation of the secret history of the Mongols. And because it was secret, it was not really rediscovered till the 19th century. For 600 years or so, very few people, or in fact, nobody, knew about the secret history. It was only rediscovered in the 19th century, and then it took quite a while. It was difficult to translate. It's only in terms of translations, the most important one was only done in the 21st century by a man named Igor Dorashevets, a detailed translation of the work with identifying the leading characters, identifying the terms used, and so on and so forth. But the general picture was known before then, of course. There were earlier translations. It's a mixture of myth, of history, and it provides one of the few primary sources on the Mongols, and particularly on the life of Genghis Khan. Tends to be reliable, but there are sections of it which are mythological and legendary, so one has to be careful in terms of using it for reliable history. It tends to have a particular point of view about Genghis, and it plays him up as a more important figure, as a major figure in world history, and that's really true. But there are sections of it that have to be evaluated carefully for reliability and for accuracy. But it's full of interesting legends. It's full of stories. It's not your typical history. It's a lot of it is anecdotal and lots of fun. And I think some of the translations bring that together.
There is some speculation on who actually wrote the history, because as the most recent translation of it suggests that it had to be someone close to Genghis Khan, because, you know, there weren't too, as was mentioned, there weren't too many who were able to write at the time. So I think there is mainly three persons, I don't remember their names, but there are mainly three persons surrounding Genghis that should have possibly written. But I think also, again, the author of the recent translation of the secret history, he kind of ruled them out as well, because there is him, and he gives some perfectly fine reasons for this, but there is, again, we do not know who has written the secret history either.
No, that's absolutely correct. There is speculation as to who wrote the secret history, and a number of candidates have been suggested, but even Dorashevets, the leading scholar on the secret history, didn't come to a final conclusion. He speculated on the writer and speculated on the reasons that the work was created. It was created in a sense to legitimize the Mongols make them an acceptable force in Asia during that time period, and provide them with opportunities to consider themselves the equals kind of the Chinese or the other great civilizations of Asia at that time. There have been lots of translations. One of the most translated books in world literature. There have been Hungarian translations, Japanese translations, English translations, French translations. It's everybody gets a different perspective on them. And it provides one of the sources on Genghis. It's not the only one. There are Persian works, Persian histories. This was a great era in Persian writing. And the Persians had a particular point of view about Genghis. One of the great works about Genghis, which is probably as authentic and as reliable as the secret history, was written by a Persian historian. Hmm. So there are a number of texts, and there are Chinese sources. There are others that add to the information that's provided in the secret history.
So let's begin with the birth of Temujin, as it was called early on. And some scholars place its birth around 1162. And let's talk about his upbringing and growing up in the Mongol society. And again, in the secret history, his mother does seem to be playing a huge part of the secret history. I remember reading that there is this story where she took her breast out of something and told them that each of you sucked on this breast when they were young, and then, tried to teach them a lesson that they are. Then it's a while since I read it, but it's rather amusing story and how she tried to lecture them by, taking out some breasts and saying that each of you had sucked on these breasts.
Sure, sure. There are lots of little anecdotes and stories about this, and some are quite fun. As to Genghis himself, he was born, as you say, in 1162, probably. And was born part to the lower nobility, not to the upper levels of Mongol society at that point. It was a time, what made him important was he brought the Mongols together. Because when he was born, there were continuous struggles among the Mongols over land, pasture land, over water rights, all sorts of things. And the Mongols were fragmented. What he created was, for the first time, unity among the Mongols. That probably is his most important contribution to the Mongols. We think of Genghis Khan as a great conqueror. He didn't conquer very much. The conquests that occurred were really in the second and third generations. All of the conquests, like China, Russia, Middle East, occurred during the time of his sons and grandsons, not Genghis's time. So he was not a great conqueror. He's often referred to as Genghis the Conqueror, but actually his most important contribution is unity. The stories about him, there are lots of little stories. One of the stories that indicates that he came from the lower nobility was the fact that he was married off at the age of 8 or 9, but instead of the wife coming to his household, he went to the wife's household, an indication that he was achieving social mobility. By usually the usual pattern, if you have a marriage, was that the girl would be brought to the boy's household and live there. But in this case, Genghis was taken, or as he was known at that point, Temujin. Genghis is a title. Temujin went at the age of 8 or 9 to his intended for marriage and would live with them and would live in a better environment than he was brought up in, higher status and so on. And the father brought him. The father, on the way back, was assassinated. And at that point, Temujin had to return to his original family in order to take care of his mother, take care of some of his siblings. And so he was separated from his intended for some years. Stories in the secret history don't always portray him in a positive light. There is one story where he had a kind of disagreement about food and other questions with one of his half-brothers. And he, instead of resolving the dispute peacefully, he went out when his half-brother was fishing and took a bow and arrow and shot his half-brother dead. Something you wouldn't think of as very heroic, and yet it's included in the secret history. So not all of his traits are regarded as positive in the secret history. That's why it can be thought of as more reliable, perhaps, than other historical accounts of great heroic figures. In any case, his mother is appalled at what he has done, but she can't do anything about it. She's not going to throw him out or anything. But she uses the incident, as a means of pointing out that unity is most important in survival in the Mongolian, in the difficult Mongolian steppe lands. And she emphasizes this to him, and she emphasizes a concept of so-called Anda, A-N-D-A, a Mongolian term meaning blood brotherhood. You form blood brotherhoods with other people, and that way you're better off, you and your blood brother are better off, and unity becomes a cardinal aspect of Chinggis's early life. That doesn't always mean that he sticks to the Anda. When he feels that the Anda is moving away, or when he believes that he's more powerful than the Anda, he sometimes severs that connection. But he builds up a whole series of groups that are loyal to him through the Anda institution. And by the time you get into the late 12th century, when he's in his 30s, he's become a very prominent figure in Mongolia with a powerful military force. Again, there are myths about his military achievements. Most of the military aspects had already been devised by nomadic peoples. The use of the horse and the use of cavalry, shooting accurately while you're riding at full speed on a horse. A lot of tactics and strategy had been devised much earlier. So he's not a major military innovator. He was much more of an organizational and administrative person. And perhaps you want to intercede here.
No, that's fine. Then go on, please.
Yeah, what made him powerful was also abandoning the idea of a hierarchy. Instead of choosing and selecting men based upon their role in the nobility and their role in the hierarchy, he based his selection of men in his military on merit. A very different kind of approach than had been the case with many of the Mongol units and many of the Mongol troops before that time. So somebody from a lower class background who showed himself to be brave or courageous or skilled in one form or another would be helped by Genghis and would be incorporated and advanced in his unit. In addition, he was quite willing to use foreigners. When he realized that foreigners had particular skills, such as using catapults, using in attacks on cities, and using siege engines, again, in attacks on cities, he was quite willing to recruit them and give them high positions in the Mongol hierarchy. So that again, those kinds of administrative decisions made him what he was, not so much his military innovations, but his administrative and organizational patterns. And he actually wanted to establish rule, not just conquest, not just attacking, but the areas that he did incorporate, he wanted to establish a government. That was different from earlier nomadic pastoral groups who simply got what they wanted, got the treasures they wanted during attacks that they made against foreigners, and went back and did not really start any sort of organized governmental structure. Genghis left behind him a pattern of organization. He wanted to move beyond conquest. And in order to do that, he developed policies that made it possible to do so, to become a ruler of eventually a multi-ethnic, multilinguistic empire. He set the stage for his sons and grandsons to conquer and establish control over the largest contiguous land empire in world history, stretching all the way from Korea through China, through Central Asia, through the Middle East, through Russia, and they actually reached all the way to Hungary. They abandoned Hungary, but they defeated the Hungarians in 1241. But they basically created an empire that no one else has ever established, based upon these principles that Genghis set up. And most of them were administrative, not military necessarily. Do you want to discuss some of the administrative policy?
Yes, and I want to add as well, I believe that in his latest book, The Earth Transformed, Peter Frankopan as well contributed that climate change was an essential part of in favor of Genghis Khan's conquest.
Yeah, the climate change did have an impact on, there are two things that happened in the late 12th and early 13th centuries that prompted the Mongols to move from Mongolia and to begin their conquests both to the south and to the west. One was from 1190 to about 1210, there was a drop in the annual mean temperature of Mongolia, which meant that the growing season was cut short. Less grass for the animals, fewer plants for the animals. The animals would have died without some sort of movement. They couldn't survive in Mongolia because of the reduction in plants at that point. Subsequently, after 1210 to 1220, the time when the conquest began, things began to change. Much more precipitation, more plants, and the horses in particular had the ability to consume more plants, were fattened up, and could be ready for conflict and for warfare. So on the one hand, you have a period of decline in terms of the plants from 1190 to about 1210. Then when you're set to begin conquests to the east and to the west and south, you have a much more robust plant structure, which helps you and allows the horses. The horses have to consume a tremendous amount in order to survive and in order to be ready for conflict, for warfare. So when that happened throughout Mongolia and Central Asia, when the climate changed and was more favorable, the conquests were much easier, more facilitated. And so on the one hand, you have decline forcing them to move. On the other hand, subsequently, you have the ability to move as a result of a more favorable precipitation, a more favorable environment. And that's really what led to the beginnings of the conquest in the West and in China as well.
I want to go back a little bit. I'm so, sorry for interrupting you, but you know, before we talk a little bit about the conquest, and we're going to talk about that more about them in a bit. But I want to talk about the unification of Mongolia as well, and how the unification of Mongolia happened, and how we eventually led to get the name of Genghis Khan.
Well, Genghis, as I said, used the institution of Anda, blood brotherhood, to bring people under his control. He was recognized as a superior figure by many individuals. Many were attracted by the fact that he emphasized merit as a means of recruiting officials, and so they were attracted by that concept. And as he organized people for the first time in a specific way, in units of about 10, up to the unit of about 10,000, he used that as an organizational pattern for his troops, and appointed one of his sons or a very loyal figure as the leader of each 10,000 man unit. In some cases, they weren't 10,000. Some cases, they were 8,000 or 12,000, whatever. But the 10,000-man idea was critical to the development of his strategy. And the head of each 10,000 unit determined gains, determined rewards to the members of the 10,000. And was absolutely loyal to Temujin. In the end, all of this structure led in 1204 and 1206, 1206 in particular, to his being granted the title of Genghis Khan. And it used to be thought that the title meant Khan of all within the oceans. But more recent thinking is that it really meant ferocious or powerful Khan, not so much all of the oceans. And by that point, by 1206, he had set up this system of 10,000s that worked kind of brilliantly for him, and meant that you had a loyal contingent that supported all of his efforts. So when he became Genghis, he was confident that he could depend upon these various segments of the Mongol Empire as part of his own, the Mongol territory as part of his own. And that allowed him that kind of loyalty, which was enforced. I mean, there were rewards and punishments for those who joined him. If they tried to break away or if they didn't follow orders, there were very severe punishments that were inflicted on those who disobeyed orders from the Great Khan. Some cases it would mean death, execution, if they did so. So it was not just rewards; there were punishments allocated to those who joined his forces. By the time you get into 1206, he's got the largest force in Mongolia. He's provided absolutely important training in cavalry warfare to his troops. He uses the traditional strategy and tactics that were developed by nomads from time immemorial. And The result was that he had this very powerful force. The one thing that you have to remember, though, was that he developed policies also that attracted non-Mongols. Without the non-Mongols and without the support of people like the Uyghurs, Uyghur Turks, I don't know if you know about them. The Uyghurs are Turkic people who were among the first to develop a written language of the nomadic pastoral groups. And the Uyghur writing system is the basis of the Mongolian writing system. When Genghis began to develop a government, he needed Uyghurs who were literate to help him in setting up a tax system, in setting up censuses. And so without the foreigners, the Mongol Empire would not have taken place, would not have succeeded. So it was critical for him to recruit and use non-Mongols in setting up the structure that he would eventually leave to his descendants. So it's the Mongols alone could not have succeeded. They needed foreign help. And so one of the things he transmitted to his sons and grandsons was use foreigners who are loyal. When Kublai Khan took over all of China, there were 75 million Chinese and less than 500,000 Mongols. He absolutely needed to get the support of Chinese in order to rule China. The government of China during that time, a lot of it was run by Chinese, not by Mongols. The Mongols were in total charge, but they couldn't have succeeded without Chinese help. And that principle of using foreigners, recruiting foreigners, came about through Genghis's ideas. As I said, his administrative innovations were the ones that really were critical in terms of the development of a Mongol empire. So that was really important. As they moved farther and farther west and conquered more and more, they used Persians, they used Russians, they used Turkic peoples, really to help them rule this multi-ethnic, multilinguistic empire. Without the support of these foreigners, there would have been no Mongol Empire. A critical insight that Genghis Khan had, and that was followed up by his descendants, and allowed them to rule.
So let's talk about the beginning of the conquest. You spoke a little bit about it earlier, but let's talk about expanding from Mongolia of course, expanding their beginning of the empire.
Sure. The first...
I'm sorry for interrupting you, but before we do this, I want as well to talk about tactics of the Mongol army and what will later become what they call the Golden Horde at this point. And so let's talk about military and tactics that they used before we go into the conquest. I want to go back a little bit further. Sure. So let's talk a little bit about this before.
Sure. The military, every Mongol male was eligible for the military and remained eligible for the military till the age of about 60. So they were trained very early on in horsemanship, for example. You see that even today. There's a holiday in Mongolia in July where there are three contests: wrestling, horseback riding, and archery. The horseback riding event, the horse race, is for children under the age of 8. Oh. They can get on the horse and really race. I mean, they really do, over lots of kilometers. So that's a tradition that was initiated Very early on, kids were put on horses at a very early childhood. I've seen kids in Mongolia riding in a horse at the age of three or so. So that was one very important element, probably the most important element in terms of the army. They had to be competent on horses. Bow and arrow. The Mongols were taught archery, and they developed a specific kind of bow and arrow that had a range much longer than the so-called longbow in Europe at that point, about a double of the range of a double or perhaps even triple of the range of that the Europeans had. They had a crossbow that had a range of about 250, 300 feet. And the most that the longbow had at that point was about 100 and 100, 125 feet. So that gave them a tremendous advantage in archery or in combat with foreigners that they engaged in. Let me just stop for a minute. I want to get some water.
Yeah, of course, I'll just put the break for a second and we'll be right back after this. And we're back.
Okay. So those two skills were vital. Being able to ride and without any inhibitions, without any impediments, was number one. Number two was the ability to shoot a bow and arrow while riding at a fast clip. That again was unique to the Mongols. Most archers in other parts of the world had to remain stable in one location, one particular ground, one particular area to shoot their bows and arrows. The Mongols could do it while riding at full speed. So that, gave them a considerable advantage. They were then trained. The way that the training occurred was in a so-called nerge, spelled N-E-R-G-E. They would come together in a circle and surround a group of animals. And the idea was to capture and kill the animals as a means of training soldiers. Hunting was, particularly in wintertime, was thought of as a means of training the military forces. And this nerge was used throughout the winter. And if you showed any cowardice as you met an animal rushing for you and tried to escape, you were not going to be accepted by Genghis as part of his military force, and in some cases you might be punished. So the traits that were essential for warfare were mandated in terms of hunting, in terms of the nerge that they went through. So there are all sorts of elements that preceded warfare. You needed to be well-trained in order to become part of Genghis's forces. And you needed to accept orders, and even if it meant putting yourself in grave danger, you had to accept what you were told in combat in order to be accepted. And so that was a critical part of the whole element of being a part of the military force. Everybody was part of the military force, and every male. And that meant, basically, when they went on campaign, what that does, of course, is to make women particularly important. If you go off and have total male mobilization, kids, even kids at the age of 12 or 13, you need somebody to take care of the economy. You need somebody to take care of the animals. And so women could do it. And there are many prominent women among the Mongols who played a very important role in the success of the Mongols. The women could take care of the animals, and some of them could even took part in warfare. There was one renowned woman, a cousin, or niece, actually, of Kublai Khan, who's played up in all of the sources and is mentioned in Marco Polo, who was a kind of female Amazon who would not marry until she was defeated in a contest by a prospective suitor. They would have to bet 100 horses to take her on in a wrestling match or in a archery competition and so on. According to Marco, she accumulated 10,000 horses as part of this. She was quite remarkable. One last figure, a Mongol prince, bet 1,000 horses to take her on and defeat her and marry her. The night before the contest, her parents came in and urged her to allow herself to be defeated. She didn't. She wouldn't agree with that. She won, and the prince went. Had to give up his 1,000 horses. That was what was the ideal for women, being able to replace the men and being able to play an important role in the economy and in warfare. And the result was that women had more rights among the Mongols than any people in Europe, in Asia at that point, and probably in Europe. They had the right to own property, which was remarkable in Asia at that time. They had the right to own the animals, which was really unique, and also to have land as the Mongols took in more and more land. Kublai Khan's mother, for example, had an enormous amount of land in northern China that was granted to her by the Mongol court. So women were extremely important in this whole enterprise. And that's something that's just been recognized by scholars of the Mongol era. There are more and more books now on prominent women who played a role in the survival and the success of the Mongols.
If all the men, right, leave for campaign and you're only woman, that you have to defend yourself, right? If there is a foreign invasion while the men are gone
They'd have to be able to. Yeah, exactly. So they had military skills as well. They were trained. They could ride horses as well, and they could shoot bows and arrow. No question about it. So the women were in a...
Imagine how easy prey it would have been for foreigners to do this if they weren't trained militarily, or if you just were left alone and all the guys were out campaigning.
Yeah, exactly. And so they had to be self-confident, and they had to be able to defend themselves. Absolutely. So it was quite important. And by having that, they could also, of course, have rights that women in other locations, they didn't have bound feet. For example, the Chinese women at that point had their feet bound and their mobility was very limited. Mongol women, nothing like that. They had to have mobility in order to survive in the steppe lands. So it was quite a difference between the Mongol women in Japan, Mongol women and Japanese women, Korean women, Chinese women. So I think that's sometimes ignored, but is a byproduct of the Mongol kind of lifestyle and was accepted by Genghis. His mother, he idolized his mother. He idolized his wife. Often his wife would take a role in policymaking decisions. Same with his sons and grandsons. One of his grandsons who took over Persia, conquered Persia, had a Christian wife, an Nestorian Christian wife, who played a very important role in policies in Persia. Kublai Khan's wife in China had an important role. So it's something we can't ignore. We think of the Mongols mostly as marauders, as male-oriented, but they couldn't have succeeded without women and the ability of women to play an important role in all of this. I think that's critical.
That, you let me nicely in there, because I want to talk about one of perhaps the biggest myths in the world, and that is that, of course, most people think that, oh, I'm probably descendants of Genghis Khan at some point, because he has so many infidelities, supposedly, that everyone is most likely to have some mongrel descent, or so they like to say. But I think that's more or less a myth. So let's talk about
it. It's a little bit exaggerated.
He had kind of this so many infidelities and so many kids around him.
Yeah, there's a lot of exaggeration, of course, because the Mongols did carve out this enormous empire, took over lots of different territories, and obviously raped or intermarried, and had obviously a lot of children. It's hard to tell who was a direct descendant of Genghis Khan. We don't have his DNA. We don't know where he was buried, actually, whether he was buried or not. We don't have any tools for being able to judge whether somebody is a direct descendant of Genghis Khan.
Wouldn't that DNA have died out by now anyway, like it's thousand years in?
Yeah, absolutely. So it'd be difficult to determine. Nobody knows where. There are lots of theories about his death. One theory was that very prominent one that came up about 25 years after his death in Chinese sources was he died and he was taken. He died in Central Asia, away from Mongolia, and he was transported thousands of miles to northeastern Mongolia, where a tomb was erected for him. And everybody en route was slaughtered, so there'd be no way to find out where he was taken. The group that took him and along with him were taken 40 women and 40 horses who were executed at the site of the tomb that he would need in the afterlife. And the guards who came out were also killed. That probably is a myth. They didn't know how to preserve bodies. And so to take Genghis's body across in the summer, all the way thousands of miles to northeast Mongolia would not probably have worked. The usual, Igor, the best biographer of Genghis, thinks that what happened was they had not set up a tomb culture yet. They weren't like the Chinese or Persians to bury their dead in elaborate ways. And they had this feeling of the connection between man and animal. So they would let the body be consumed by the animals in a particular area. I don't know. It's hard to figure out what happened. There are all sorts of, legends and myths. But to get back, you want to get back to how these conquests began.
Yeah.
Well, the conquest began with a group in northwest China who controlled the Silk Road trade, who controlled the caravans that went from China towards the West. This group was demanding very stiff tariffs on any Mongolian cavalry that went through their territory. Genghis was appalled by this, and the Mongols were appalled by this, and so they attacked this group. It was a kind of a standoff, but the group eventually supposedly submitted to the Mongols and decreed that they would not impose stiff taxes on the caravan, stiff tariffs. So he got what he wanted. He did not occupy that territory. He went back to Mongolia. He got the economic objective that he wanted and went back to his territory. Next step, the Mongols desperately need trade, particularly in bad winters when thousands and 10,000s of animals die. They can't get to the grass. There's a tremendous amount of snow or ice over the grasslands. The animals can't get to the life-preserving plants, and they die by the thousands and 10,000s. In that kind of situation, there's a food crisis for the Mongols, and they depend upon trade with China to get the goods they want, to get the food they desire. Also, they depend upon China for any manufactured craft goods that they need, nails, tents, anything. So trade is very important. When they're denied trade, they have to raid. They have to attack the Chinese settlements. And that's what happened in the early 13th century. A group in northern China, that controlled northern China, denied them trade. So the second campaign that Chinggis led was against the northern Chinese. That was a brutal and bloody campaign on both sides. But eventually, by 1215, he had defeated that group and got what he wanted. That is, they were willing to trade once again with the Mongols and provide them with the goods that they needed, food and other commodities. And the result was that he went back to Mongolia. He didn't occupy northern China at that point. He wasn't somebody who was a conqueror. The third and last campaign, one of his caravans going through Central Asia was stopped by a governor in a particular area, and all 400 Mongols and Muslims on the caravan were executed. When Chinggis learned about this, he sent an envoy, an embassy, to the leader of the whole area, and demanded that the governor be sent to him for punishment. The leader had no idea who Chinggis Khan was. He had no idea of the military force that Chinggis had set up, organized. And so he executed one of the envoys for being insolent and sent the others home. From the Mongol standpoint, that's the worst crime you could commit. The Mongols would never harm an ambassador. They would never harm a foreign envoy. And so this crime had to be avenged. That turned out to be the biggest of Chinggis's campaigns. Supposedly, he organized a contingent of about 200,000 troops. Probably an exaggeration. But there were quite a few troops that went on this campaign to Central Asia, towards places like Samarkand, Bukhara, and close to Afghanistan. They set forth in about 1219. It would be a 4 or 5 year campaign. Both sides massacred each other. There were terrible massacres in Samarkand, Bukhara, other places. But eventually, Chinggis emerged victorious. This time, because there'd been such opposition, he decided to control the area. That was the only area he conquered, Central Asia. He set up a government there under one of his sons and headed back to Mongolia. So that territory was the beginning of the Mongols' conquest towards the west.
Hmm. So just talk a little bit about his death, but it does become 65 years, which is quite old for that time, I believe.
I'm sorry, I
And
couldn't hear you.
I do believe in the secret history, it says that he fell from his horseback of his death, I think. And but again, when you are that old, are 65, it's and you ride on the horseback and been campaigning, it's kind of, understandable. It would be difficult to keep up on the horse all day at that age, I
Yeah.
think. Wouldn't it?
You mean his death?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, there are all sorts of legends. I mean, he probably died of old age. There is one legend that he got an arrow wound and was shot in the shoulder. It wasn't taken care of properly. Gangrene set in, and that led to his collapse. Another one is the one you pointed out about the fall from a horse.
It
There are
sounds
tons of.
plausible, kind of. And again, then at the age of 65, it kind of sounds plausible that he would fall off the horseback. And to bring do an analogy here, I think the same thing happened with Eric the Red when he died in the
Right.
Viking Age, that he also fell off his horseback and he was quite old. So it's kind of, to do an analogy at
Yeah,
that, it
it
kind of
could be
makes
a narrative,
sense.
a narrative story. It's difficult to tell. I can't come up with a real sort of response to that. It's a he died. There are lots of legends. One, I was one in, once interviewed in New York, where I live, by a local public radio station, and we talked for about an hour on tape before the program, talking as we've been talking about Genghis's life and his conquests, his all of his policies and so on. But the interviewer wanted something. He said, "Wasn't there something colorful about his death?" I said, "Well, there's a crazy story about his death. Makes no sense, but I'll talk about it. You don't need to put it on the radio." He said that he had taken a wife from one of the chieftains he had defeated. She didn't want to be taken, and so she placed a knife in her vagina. As they were having sex, he was killed by the knife. Well,
I mean, that's a way to go
that
as
was a
well.
crazy story, crazy story. That was the only thing he put on the radio, and so people think of me as a pervert of some sort or other. It was they play it all the time. Every time there's a campaign to raise money for the station, every year or so, they play this little excerpt of me talking about this crazy story. It's a crazy story. They're just crazy legends. They're not accurate. And the st students who hear this sometimes, where I get responses from them that I have to somehow or other point out that it is a crazy story. So you have to be careful with interviews.
Yeah, but and I'm not definitely not just gonna put that out. I'm gonna like edit this clip and just make it where you speak about the penis, the death of a vagina. So that's
Yeah,
gonna be the whole episode.
I believe that one.
But seriously, before we end the episode as well, I want to talk about Succession because I did have quite a few children, and one of the one we now know would succeed him would be Orchidae. So that's but was there a certain that Orchidae would be the one to succeed Genghis, or was there as there all usually is in this
Sure.
kind of situation, a succession crisis?
Well, that was to prove the succession to Genghis, the fact that he didn't work out a regular, orderly system of succession was to prove one of the factors in the decline and fall of the Mongols. There are a number of different traditions among the Mongols for succession. One was younger brother. If the older brother died, the younger brother would take power. Second was something called ultimogeniture. The youngest son of a ruler would become the successor. The idea was that the older sons would have had time to establish themselves, to have their own troops, to have their own families, and so on. That the youngest son needed the protection of the father. Third, which was the one that was eventually chosen, was that the Mongol nobility would get together and choose a successor. It had to be a direct descendant of Genghis, but it could be a son, it could be a grandson, it could be a nephew. And that created problems because different nobles would think somebody else was more meritorious than anybody that was chosen. And so there was a question of legitimacy for each successor. The only one where there was no conflict was Ögedei. That is, Genghis himself decreed that Ögedei would be the successor. But he didn't set this up as a regular orderly system, so that when Ögedei died in 1241, there was a mess for 5 years. No ruler of the Mongol Empire at a time when it had reached a colossal amount of territory. It had taken over Russia, taken over Central Asia, North China. So it took a tremendous effort to restore order in 1246. And even then, the great Khan that was chosen died 2 years later. And so there was another interregnum till 1251. In 1251, Kublai Khan's brother became the ruler for 8 years. And then there would be conflict repeatedly, so that really by 1260, there was no empire. There were four separate segments, one in China and Korea. That was the original kind of khanate, one in Central Asia, one in Russia called the Golden Horde, and one in Persia in the Middle East. There was no one leader who was in charge. And even within each of those segments, there was conflict because they had no regular system of succession. So Kublai Khan, for example, had to fight his brother in order to become the head of the East Asian part of the Mongol domains. When Kublai died in 1294, over a period of 40 years, there would be nine separate Khans, none of them lasting more than 5 years. Two of them were murdered, others were pushed aside. So the Mongols did themselves in by not having a regular orderly system of succession. The same thing happened in Persia, same thing happened in Central Asia.
And of course, I do believe at some point you get the term Crimean Khanate as well.
Yeah, same problem. Same problem. And that pretty much did them in. In addition, there was one other problem that arose. Some of the Mongols became very captivated by the civilization that they ruled, became fascinated by China, fascinated by Persia, and began to adopt some features or some institutions of China and Persia, wherever they were. And that put them at odds. It put them at odds with people who wanted to maintain the traditional Mongol values and traditional Mongol structure and did not want to be polluted by Chinese values, by Chinese institutions. So that kind of struggle went on, and that kind of conflict leading to warfare in some cases between traditionalists and those who accepted other aspects of Chinese or Persian civilization. So they did themselves in, basically.
I do believe, I don't remember if this was in Genghis Khan's lifetime, but they did try to attack Japan at some point as well. Was there ever a chance that they would succeed in conquering Japan?
Taking over Japan. That was in the time of Kublai Khan. The Mongols at that point had reached their territorial limits. They had taken over all the land from East Asia westward. So expansion would have to be overseas. Kublai sent an embassy to Japan to have them submit, without any kind of conflict, without warfare, without sending an invasion group. The Japanese refused. And Kublai took the next step. He sent a military force, a naval force in 1274. Not well prepared. He didn't realize that he needed a well-organized group. They got near Japan. It was a bad storm. And the Korean sailors convinced the Mongol commander to head back. So that first campaign ended without actually combat. Kublai determined to set up a much bigger force, and he spent the next 7 years doing that. They prepared a big armada and two invasion groups, one coming from the north, one coming from the south, meeting in a place in Japan, and intending to take over Japan militarily. What they didn't realize was at the time that they set forth was a time when typhoons were quite common. And so as they approached Japan, a typhoon erupted. Many of the Mongol ships were not adequate to defend themselves against the typhoon. They were not ocean vessels. They were not ocean-bearing vessels. They've been built in lakes and rivers. A lot of the Mongol forces were drowned. Ships were sunk. And Japanese, only a few landed in Japan and were defeated by the Japanese samurai.
I mean, mentioned the secret history in the beginning of the podcast and throughout this episode, but preservation of the secret history, I don't remember if this was under Kublai Khan's era, but this because of the Chinese conquest and because the Mongol rule in China, that it was interpreted, preserved, and put into Chinese history of the Mongols as well, that it's part reasons why we have the secret history today, that the Chinese, they adapt. They not adapted, but they took care of preserve the secret history.
Sure, and they did preserve it, and they added to it from their point, from their perspective, in their dynastic histories of the dynasty, the Mongol dynasty that was set up, the so-called Yuan dynasty, quite extensive. But it is from the Chinese perspective, not the Mongol perspective. So one has to be careful in using it to get, a totally accurate and reliable history of the time period. It's quite good in many ways, but, it has to be it has to be kept in mind that that it was written by the Chinese, not by the Mongols. And there are lots of other Chinese sources that describe the Mongols and the Mongol era. Again, in some cases they're positive, in some cases they're quite negative. And so one has to be, selective in how to use these sources.
And something one last thing I want to talk about as well is the portrayal of Genghis Khan in pictures and artwork, because not all are, of course, too favorable in one way. I mean, that could be just the artwork of his time, but as someone pointed out, Genghis Khan basically was a normal human being. He didn't look like, you know, the way we see him in some artwork from that portrayal. He didn't look like you and me, a normal man, normal size human being, I believe.
Yeah, well, the depictions of Genghis in foreign sources can be very misleading. He's mentioned all over the world. I mean, the Mongols probably are mentioned in more sources, the Mongol Empire, more written sources, everything from Armenian, the whole Armenian chronicles about
I think they left their mark, it's fair to say.
Yeah, to say the least, they did. You know, for the most part, it's negative, no question about it. The Persians portray him negatively, portray the Mongols negatively. The Russians also, up through the Soviet period, up through the 20th century, portrayed him in a very, very negative light. And the Soviets had considerable influence in Mongolia in the 20th century. So even the Mongols, from 1921 to 1990, when they were very heavily influenced by the Soviet Union, didn't portray him in a positive light. Since then, there's been a reevaluation, and which has gone to the other extreme, so that in Mongolia now, there's a Mongolian beer, there's a Genghis Khan beer, there's a Genghis Khan hotel, Genghis Khan is on the paper money, Genghis Khan, there's a Genghis Khan airport. He's portrayed in a truly very, very positive light, and one has to be careful about that. Then popular writers have portrayed him as a believer in democracy, as a believer in international law, as a believer in women's rights, and so on. One has to take that with a grain of salt. But it happens when you go from one extreme to another, from really negative to overly positive. And I've tried to stay in the middle and tried to point out that he made important contributions to world history, but that he also, of course, marauded, killed, massacred quite a few people. And democracy is not something that he necessarily believed in. And international law is certainly not something he believed in, was Mongolian law. So, you know, these things happen, and it's hard to regulate what happens in the popular media. But, you know, there's been a good reevaluation of the Mongols over the past 20 or 30 years. We've seen them play an important role in a variety of areas in bringing the world together. This was the first time there was direct contact between Europe and China, was brought about by the Mongols. The Mongols transmitted a lot of Chinese culture to the Middle East and to the West. I was part of an exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in 2002, which showed how the Mongols played an important role in transmitting Chinese art and Chinese motifs into Persian art, and played an important role in the renaissance of Persian art during that time period. So, you know, there's been an effort to reevaluate the Mongol era.
I covered the Golden Horde earlier this year in March, February. I don't remember exactly when, but we talked about how the Pax Mongolica was a thing where, you know, the Silk Road was probably safer than it ever had been before under Mongol rule. We had this, what we called in the episode, modern gas station, sort of, where you had some pit stops, you know, for the people traveling the same route. And you mentioned that that was negative in that light, but that was one of the contribution. And of course, you didn't mention it in the episode, but the mail system was fantastic under Mongol Empire. The mail delivery was out of this world, and I think in that Genghis Khan contributed to the
Mongols. Absolutely. And I think this podcast has your interest and this is I think is a useful contribution to a reevaluation or reconsideration of the Mongols in a positive light, but also mentioning the negative. So I'm delighted.
That he did not die by vagina.
Yeah. Well, it's nice to talk to you, and I'll hope to hear from you again.
And before you go, thank you so much for coming on. Do you have anything you want to promote? Any social media where people might find you, or where can people buy your books if they want to read more about True Black Khan or the Mongol history?
Sure. I've done some studies of the traditional Mongols. I'm now interested in modern Mongolia as well. But a Kublai Khan book, which was taken up by the History Book Club in the United States and sold extremely well. It's a book meant for the general reader, not just for experts. And I think a general reader who's interested in history might find it of use. The other book that's put out by the Oxford University Press is part of a series that is meant for the ordinary reader. It's called The Mongols, I think a beginner's guide or something like that. And it's about 100 pages on the Mongols and gives you a general vision of the Mongols. And those are the two that I would recommend if people are interested in my own work. The best biography of Genghis is I don't know if it's in print anymore, but it's a very good work. It's by Paul Rachnevsky, spelled Rachnevsky. Rachnevsky. It's called Genghis Khan, and it's reliable. And again, it's meant for a general audience. It was published a long time ago, in I think in the 1980s or so. So it's not easily available, but that's a work that's useful. The Secret History is available in many editions.
Thank you so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast. We are available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you can find podcasts. If you are an Apple Podcast, consider writing a review of the podcast. That would help us out a lot. We read out a review last episode in the part one of the Yulu Claudian Dynasty, and I can read out your review as well if I see you after you've written one review. If you are on Spotify, give us 5 stars. If you listen on YouTube, like, share, and subscribe. This has been Well That Aged Well. My name is Alan, and I'll see you next time.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.